From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Senate Republicans are still trying to find a way to move forward with some version of health care reform. The focus now is on a so-called skinny repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which would likely eliminate the mandate both that people have health insurance and that employers offer it, and it would get rid of one tax on medical devices. Julie Rovner is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She joins us now. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Jeremy.
So where are we on all of this? I mean, what do we know about what this skinny repeal would be, other than, of course, zero calories, as everything skinny is?
That's right. Officially, we know nothing. We have rumors about what would be in it. There have been a couple of other rumors that go along with what you just mentioned. Defunding of Planned Parenthood is rumored to be in it. An elimination of the Prevention Public Health Fund is rumored to be in it. And a possible further delay of the Cadillac tax. That's an unpopular tax on very generous health plans. It's also rumored to be in it. But we honestly don't know what's in it because Republicans haven't told anybody yet.
But if it does get rid of the individual mandate and the employer mandate, wouldn't that effectively trigger the collapse of Obamacare?
Yeah, not the employer mandate. Actually, there's been a lot of research that's found that the employer mandate actually hasn't done that much. It's only for large employers. Most large employers already offer health insurance. Mm. There's been a lot of thought that you could get rid of the employer mandate and not much would happen. The individual mandate is a whole nother story. If there is no requirement for healthy people to get in and yet insurers have to sell to sick people, that is basically the prescription for the dreaded death spiral that we keep talking about. And indeed, just this morning, the insurance industry came out again and said this would not be a good idea to just get rid of the mandate without getting rid of the insurance regulations that go along with them. The Congressional Budget Office said last night that if they went ahead and did that, there were about 16 million people would lose insurance and premiums would go up at 20% a year.
And I've seen reporting also that the insurance markets could be in chaos after that.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that the insurance industry has been saying, it's not just whether or not they do this. It's the uncertainty of not doing anything. We're getting into the final weeks before insurers have to decide once and for all if they're going to offer coverage for next year, for 2018. You've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 17 million people in the individual market, in and outside of the exchanges, and these insurers could pull out entirely from the entire individual market. And then you'd be hurting not just, you know, the people who are on the exchanges, the people who are off the exchanges. It's everything is kind of teetering on the brink right now.
Does it look like Republicans have the votes in the Senate for this?
That's also completely unclear. That's what they're trying to put together is something that can get 50 votes and that let Vice President Pence break a tie. We haven't seen that something yet. That's the idea, is that maybe they could coalesce around this skinny repeal bill and then go into a conference with the House. That's not what they originally wanted to do. The Senate originally wanted to pass a bill, send it to the House, tell the House, look, this is the most we can do, take it or leave it, and then have the House pass it and be done with it. That's not what they're talking about anymore. Now they're talking about going into a House-Senate conference that could take, at best, weeks, at worst, months.
And if they do the conference, both houses would still have to pass the final bill, right?
Yes. In the end, each house has to pass a bill, has to pass exactly the same bill. It can be in the form of a bill. They could send this bill to the House. The House could amend it and send it back, and then the Senate could pass it. That would do. Or they could have a formal conference where they come up with a conference report, and then each house approves the conference report. That's an up or down vote on a conference report, no amendments.
If the Senate passes the skinny repeal, we already are hearing from the House. Congressman Mark Meadows, who's the head of the Conservative House Freedom Caucus, has said, quote, there would not be enough votes to pass it and send it to the president. But he added that to use it as a vehicle to continue negotiations is certainly welcome. What might happen in the House if they were able to pass the skinny repeal in the Senate?
Well, I think a lot of other people think that there would be enormous pressure on the House, seeing how much trouble the Senate has had passing anything, to take whatever the Senate sends them. The question is, do they want to spend a lot more time trying to go back and forth and hash things out with no real prospect of getting 50 votes in the Senate? If the Senate can get 50 votes for anything, then you get the question over in the House, look, we may not like this, but is it better than nothing? So I think there would be, I understand that what Mark Meadows is saying, and it's entirely possible that that is the case, but I think it is equally possible that the House could be, you know, pushed into voting for it if it really thinks that there's nothing more that the Senate can do, or if they really need to move on to other things like tax reform.
So, Julie, just a few seconds left, but what's the timeline here?
The timeline here is that we should know in the next couple of hours what this skinny bill looks like. They're going to run out of debate time. They could be in all night voting on amendments and presumably some resolution tomorrow.
Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks, as always.
Anytime.
Well, earlier this year, in April, a home exploded in Firestone, Colorado, a small town north of Denver, killing two people. An investigation is underway, cleanup is ongoing, lawsuits are being filed, and people who live in that town are worried, not only about their safety, but about the value of their homes. The explosion was caused by a leaking pipeline attached to an oil and gas well. And in that part of Colorado, oil and gas development is everywhere, including underneath people's homes. Lee Patterson from Here Now contributor Inside Energy reports.
On Twilight Avenue in Firestone, lawns are neat squares of grass. There are lots of American flags, kids on bikes, and now there's a pile of rubble where the home exploded. John and Amy Bullers live down the street and are really upset.
Oh, I am. I don't want to live there anymore. I have two kids.
The Bullers pulled their kids out of school after the accident, and Amy took them to her parents' place in Chicago. They got even more worried when, a few weeks after the home blew up, state officials announced they'd found another pocket of gas, this time right behind the Bullers' house. That same day, an oil tank exploded a few miles away, killing a worker. Amy and John want to leave their neighborhood, but
we can't afford to move. I mean, we got our house at such a great deal like 3 years ago, and now prices have skyrocketed.
This part of northern Colorado is one of the fastest-growing metro areas in the country. Home values have gone up 11% over the past year alone. But the Bullers don't think they'd be able to sell their home right now anyway.
Like, who wants to live? We live on Twilight.
There's a stigma.
But there is. There's a stigma. Like, the second somebody says, oh, Twilight, yep, you're at that house that exploded.
I met the Bullers at a meeting between homeowners and a group of lawyers. There's talk about a lawsuit over lost home values. Lawyer Rick Kirkendall came in from Florida.
I mean, if one thing came out of that meeting tonight, it was this. People are afraid, and they're unsure, and they're uncertain. And that is a bad place to be.
He has experience in these types of lawsuits. Years ago, he represented Gulf Coast homeowners after the BP oil spill.
So if there's a theme to this case for me is, there are things that can interrupt the American dream. What will the law allow us to do to get them back to where they would have been but for the accident?
Measuring that kind of loss in home value is Ron Throop's specialty.
We are damage experts, real estate damage experts.
I met Throop on a bright, scorching hot day. He shows me around a subdivision not far from where the house exploded.
Good examples of mixing homes with drill sites.
In a 2013 study, Throop found that just living near oil and gas development can bring down the value of your home from 5% in Texas up to 15% in Florida, depending on how close the drilling actually is and how used to it the community is. Assessing damage related to accidents, the stigma that the Bullers were talking about, that's a real thing. Throop used the technical term residual stigma.
What it comes down to is, even after cleanup, cure, the prices do not come back fully to market expectations.
Erica, good morning to you. We're right at the edge of where the fire stopped. I want you to take a look at this devastation behind me. You're going to see.
That's what happened right after this 2010 accident. A natural gas utility pipeline exploded in San Bruno, California. 8 people died. The real estate market there froze. As one agent put it to me, sales fell, listings expired.
The stigma in particular is as much about fear as actual science.
Throop has found that stigma tends to stick around longer when there's an investigation or multiple incidents, as is the case in Colorado. Still, there's a lot of uncertainty about how the housing market here will react. Operators have been drilling in northern Colorado for a long time. But so many people living so close to oil and gas, that's new. Greg Zedell of Zedell Realty has lived here his whole life.
So I've been in business now for 37 years.
and has seen these changes. Zedell won't predict the future, but notes there just aren't a lot of available homes for sale, and there's a lot of demand.
Every home comes down to a very emotional purchase for most every buyer. They all have their own hot buttons as to what they want or what they don't want or what they can feel comfortable with.
Meanwhile, current residents in Firestone are installing gas monitors and waiting for answers. The Bullers, that family worried about selling their home, they've been in touch with lawyers about a potential lawsuit and have started shopping around for a new house. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Patterson.
We love birds, and we love classical music, and we love when they intersect, which is more often than you think. We featured Lyanda-Lynn Haupt's book, Mozart's Starling. Legend has it a starling sang Mozart's piano concerto back to him. Then there's Olivier Messiaen, who put birdsong in his compositions. And today through Sunday, the Tanglewood Music Festival in Lenox, Massachusetts, is presenting Tanglewood Takes Flight, a celebration of birds and music with Mass Audubon, featuring concerts and bird walks in the nearby Pleasant Valley Wildlife Sanctuary, and largely featuring the music of French composer Messiaen. Here's a selection from Messiaen's The Catalogue of the Birds. Boston Globe classical music critic Jeremy Eichler has some thoughts on the inspiration of birdsong. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
And we're going to link listeners to the magical story of Mozart and the one that we did. But remind us, he heard this bird sing in a shop, and we know that this happened because he wrote it down. He noted it in a notebook.
Right. So he notated it, and below that he wrote, Das war schön. That was beautiful. And I'm sure it was a beautiful rendition of whatever the starling was singing, but from Mozart, what was clearly the most astonishing of all was that the starling appears to have been singing one of the actual themes from the last movement of his G major piano concerto, which had never even been performed yet at that point.
So, some of my favorite stories.
Right? So how did this bird know? One person speculated that perhaps Mozart had been in the shop himself whistling as he was writing this piece, you know, earlier, and then came back, and lo and behold, the composition was done and the bird knew the melody.
This is at a time where birds played quite a role in society. People would have birds all the time to teach them to sing.
Right. It was very sort of fashionable to have a caged bird as a pet in your home. And then there were these songbooks. I think the most famous was called The Bird Fancier's Delight. And it makes suggestions per bird species of what kinds of songs you might want to teach your bird. And there was actually even a new recorder invented at the time, you know, very high pitched so that, you know, the birds could really understand what you were trying to teach.
Talk about other composers inspired by birds. You've listed several, and we want to hear some passages from them.
Well, there's most famously Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. There's a scene by the brook that has some very famous bird songs. Opera lovers, I'm sure, will remember from Wagner's Siegfried. There's the forest bird singing out to the hero. Respighi in the Pines of Rome actually plays a recording in the middle of the orchestral climax of recording of a bird.
Well, and now to Messiaen. who seem not obsessed with birds, but seem to appreciate them maybe more than any other composer. Talk more about his traveling the world to gather the sounds.
Yeah, so it's interesting when you go back to the 1700s, we had human beings teaching birds the music of humans, you know, the sense that the human beings were the teachers. And then with Messiaen, he goes and it's completely inverted. He calls birds his teachers. And this was a moment in the 1950s when music was coming out of the Second World War, and there was this real kind of quest, certainly felt by Messiaen and many others, for new sources of creative kind of grounding and spiritual meaning for music. You know, these young firebrand avant-gardist students in the conservatoire at the time would sit around the table with Messiaen, and they would literally argue with their teacher to the point that Messiaen would be reduced to tears. Messiaen would say, "Gentlemen, let us not argue like this. We are all in a profound night, and I don't know where I am going. I'm as lost as you," unquote. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to me, it just captures that moment captures a sense of Messiaen's searching for this kind of new source of values, new sources of beauty. Birds for Messiaen were a source of music and beauty that were particularly appealing precisely because they were completely separate from human history and human music.
Well, and let's remember, recent human history in that moment was World War II. And you remind us that The Abyss of the Birds, he wrote in a German prison camp.
Yes, yeah, this was part of the Quartet for the End of Time, which was written when Messiaen was captured, and apparently the available instruments at the time were piano, clarinet, cello, and violin, so he wrote for those four instruments, and The Abyss of the Birds is a solo clarinet movement within that piece where you hear plenty of birdsong and also this kind of piercingly intense beauty from the clarinet. Abyss of the Birds, I think we get this sense of Messiaen's use of the bird song in this way that was with more attention to actual details of how birds sounded. You know, composers had this abstract, inspired relationship to bird song before that, but Messiaen took this far more seriously than any other composer before him. You know, filled thousands of pages of notebooks with precise notation about what he was hearing, and then tried to bring these all into his music.
Yeah. He wrote and spoke about this. You quote one passage, "For me, it is here among the birds that music lives."
Yeah.
He's elevating birds to this really sort of spiritual level where some people think they belong. But as you write, he takes poetic license. It's not as if you might hear an exact bird call. Talk about the golden oriole. I think it's the Eurasian golden oriole. And first, here's the sound of the bird. And now, here's Messiaen.
This was from the huge multi-part composition called The Catalog of the Birds. It was introduced as a kind of introduction to birds in their natural habitats, and the movement titles had the name of the bird in them. You know, people have speculated that this particular movement of The Catalog of the Birds has a certain beauty and resplendence that perhaps had to do only with the Oriole, but also could have a little French pun behind it. It's called Le Loriot, and his own student, who went on to become his second wife, was Yvonne Loriot. So it's a little bit of a tribute, perhaps, between the notes.
This love of composers for birds was reflected elsewhere in the arts. You quote poets, including Shelley.
Right. So in Shelley's To a Skylark, you have this sense of a poet just kind of in awe of the ultimate in beauty. The famous lines he writes, "I have never heard praise of love or wine that panted forth a flood of rapture so divine." It's kind of this middle point between Messiaen and perhaps where we started with Mozart, where you have an appreciation of the birdsong as a kind of perfection and beauty, but also a sense that it's kind of a world apart from human creation.
Yeah. Jeremy Eichler, classical music critic for the Boston Globe, ahead of Tanglewood's big celebration of birds in classical music. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin, for having me.
And we leave you with Messiaen's L'Oiseau Exotique, Exotic Birds. Here and now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle. And it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
The Ohio State Fair reopened this morning with all of its rides closed after an accident on the Fireball ride last night killed an 18-year-old and injured several others. Kaylee Bellamy told Columbus's NBC4 that she was next in line when the accident happened.
And it was going for a minute, and like it was at its highest point, and I saw somebody fall out of the ride, and then a minute later, the whole like row of seats fell off and hit the ground.
Ohio Governor John Kasich described the accident as a nightmare today, but he said there's only so much that can be done as prevention.
Accidents do happen. I mean, we wish we could eliminate them. But, you know, I'm not going to stand here as a human being and say that somehow we can guarantee our safety 100% in whatever we do. But we want to.
Karen Kassler is State House News Bureau Chief. She's in Columbus. Karen, tell us more about this ride and what went wrong.
Well, this is a ride that's described as one of these thrill rides. The ride inspectors here in Ohio called it a spectacular piece, meaning it arrives in several trucks, actually four trucks with this one, and then it's set up, it's bolted together there on the site. It is a pendulum-style ride, so it swings backward and forward and spins at the same time. And this pendulum has rows of four seats, and there is a video out there that shows the ride swinging in one direction, and as it moves, one of these rows of seats actually snaps off, falls off, and falls to the ground. And it's a horrifying video. That is one of the things that inspectors are looking at to try to figure out exactly how this happened.
And we know that this ride was inspected more than once in the days before the accident.
Right. And we have a team of inspectors here at the Ohio Department of Agriculture that actually inspects all the rides, 74 rides at the Ohio State Fair. They inspected this one a couple of times. There were some questions about ride inspections, though, going up to the opening of the fair yesterday because there was a lot of rain. They got a little bit behind. But the inspectors have said this is a very important job. They were not rushed in any way. In fact, there were 11 of those rides that did not even open yesterday on the opening day of the fair because they couldn't certify that they were ready to go. This one did open, and it was inspected several times, but obviously something terribly bad went wrong.
What's going on with the investigation into this?
Well, you've got several entities that are involved in the investigation. Because this happened on the Ohio State Fairgrounds, the State Highway Patrol is investigating. Also, the Department of Agriculture, where the ride inspection team is located, they're investigating. And Kasich said at a news conference last night that he wants to know not only for Ohio, but also for other states, because these rides do travel. And so there needs to be an understanding of what actually happened here, and maybe that information can be relayed so that nothing else like this could ever happen again.
Now, yesterday was the first day of the fair. I know you were there yesterday. What do you think this means for the Ohio State Fair this year?
Well, obviously the Midway and those 70-plus rides are a huge attraction. I mean, the fair goes on today because there are livestock shows and other activities, but certainly this puts a huge damper on what is essentially the state's annual big party. The fair runs until August 6th, and so, you know, I think there's some concern about what's going to happen in terms of the financial impact of the fair, but, you know, it's a terrible tragedy, not only for the people who are involved, but all the people who were there on opening day who may have witnessed this, because this is one of the biggest days in terms of attendance. So a lot of people were there when this happened last night.
That's Karen Kassler, who is Statehouse News Bureau Chief, talking with us from Columbus about the deadly accident on the Fireball ride at the Ohio State Fair yesterday. Karen, thanks.
Great to talk to you.
At the six-month mark of the Trump administration, we've been taking a look, department by department, at the achievements of his cabinet members. Today, education. Secretary Betsy DeVos, a billionaire proponent of school choice, has faced a number of headwinds, but she got some wind at her back yesterday, announcing that President Trump would donate his salary this quarter to the education department to be used for a STEM-focused camp for students. That's $100,000, and that's great. But the department might see millions in cuts. Anya Kamenetz is NPR's lead education blogger. Anya, start with school choice. DeVos and her family have a long record of supporting vouchers, unregulated charter schools, and she wants government dollars to go towards them.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's really at the core of this. And it's an interesting coalition, you might say, between evangelical Christians, of which the DeVos family is one, as well as free market conservatives who believe that, you know, the government should get out of schools. And they both kind of agree on that. From the Christian point of view, it's to, you know, be able to teach our children what we think they should be learning, not what the government thinks they should be learning. And from the free market point of view, it's saying, you know, the government has no business providing something that, you know, that people should just, I guess, get on their own.
Last week, Secretary DeVos spoke to the American Legislative Exchange Council in Denver. That's ALEC. They back her on vouchers, education savings accounts, the expansion of charters, the virtual and for-profit schools. There were protests outside the event, but here's a bit of what she had to say inside.
Providing more educational options isn't against public schools. School choice is about recognizing parents' inherent right to choose what is best for their children.
So she says it's not about taking down public schools, but what about Congress? Is she getting support there? The Budget Committee in the House is working on a plan to cut $20 billion to education over the next 10 years. So how's she faring in Congress?
Well, you know, it's complicated because obviously the federal role in public schools from K-12 is fairly limited and always has been. And I think DeVos is sort of a big supporter of that idea. The House asked for cuts to the education budget, but actually Trump's budget request asked for even more cuts. The role of the federal education bureaucracy in promoting school choice is something that was completely eliminated by the House. So there were some proposals in Trump's budget to take money intended for poor schools and to push that money into school choice programs, essentially. And that was completely axed out by the House. So, you know, Betsy DeVos's ability to promote school choice directly from Washington, D.C. might be limited in this cycle. We're going to see what she can do with a bully pulpit.
You know, a lot of the brick and mortar of public schools is already there. They definitely need improvement and need help across the country. But can this push to school choice work with less federal dollars?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, it gets at the soul of the debate that we have over school choice, because proponents of existing public schools, and that, of course, includes teachers' unions, like to say that what we really want is high-quality schools in your neighborhood. And we already have this network of public schools that 9 out of 10 students attend. Why can't we just make those schools better? And, of course, the equally morally righteous debate on the other side says, look, my child is going to grow up and be out of school in a short period of time. I don't have time to wait for the schools to turn around. How are you going to sit there and talk to a poor family in a city and say, you know, you have to send your kid to the local school no matter how bad it is? So that's the rhetoric that rages. And the idea, should we fix the schools we have? Should we try to make new schools better? I think it's going to go on for the foreseeable future.
All right. Take us to ESSA. This is the Every Student Succeeds Act. It was signed by President Obama in late 2015. It was a reauthorization at that time of a 50-year-old national education law. What was it supposed to do, and how is it faring in the DeVos administration?
Well, in a precursor to the DeVos and the Trump administration, ESSA was really meant to return a lot of power to the states to determine how to make schools more successful and students more successful. And it was seen as a walk back of what some people saw as federal overreach during the No Child Left Behind era, which was, you know, absolutely bipartisan and pursued by both Bush and Obama. It's been a little bit of a whiplash, I would say, since DeVos and Trump came in, because first what they did was they threw out the House throughout all the regulations that had been spelling out how to implement ESSA. And this was kind of seen as a way to, again, kind of cut federal red tape, but also left states in a little bit of a limbo with how do we comply. On the other hand, the states have been, you know, coming up with their plans and turning them in. And in the first round, Betsy DeVos's Education Department returned surprisingly strong, detailed feedback on some of these state plans, which would seem to go counter to this notion of a hands-off federal education department.
Right. Criticism even from, you know, Republican supporters that it wasn't working the way it was supposed to. Mm-hmm. Well, we mentioned protests. She's had so many of them. I mentioned this past weekend in Colorado. She was at ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, a conservative organization. Here's a bit of the sound outside. Hey, Alec, you can't hide. We can see your greedy side. This is, you know, because it's because the thinking is that these are people who want to privatize public schools and make money off it. Then in May, graduates of Bethune-Cookman University in Florida turned their backs to protester giving the commencement speech after she said, you know, all black schools were the original school choice, when in fact we know they were the only thing available in racist, segregated America to most African Americans. And you've told us that you think that perhaps she wasn't really as prepared for the protest she was going to get. She was one of the most protested nominees, even in the nomination process. But talk now about some of the college issues, the new rules on student loans and the thought behind them. Can you just briefly sum that up, and how's that being received?
So in higher ed, you know, the steps that she's taken have been to walk back some pretty key regulations that were instituted by the Obama administration in response to some pretty egregious violations. You know, large for-profit colleges were shut down in the last several years. Many people left on the hook for loans from fraudulent colleges. And the act to stop regulations that are in process on the higher ed side has a lot of advocates wondering, you know, how friendly is this administration going to be to the private lending industry, to for-profit colleges versus the students that they're really sworn to protect and help.
What about campus sexual assault? DeVos excoriated for meeting with accused rapists as well as rape victims. She and some of her staffers making the point that there were false accusations. Candace Jackson, the acting assistant secretary for civil rights at the Department of Education, got in a lot of hot water when she said that 90% of campus sexual assaults fell into the category of "we were both drunk." Not that somebody was raped or someone was a rapist. She later, walked that back a bit. She is, in fact, a victim herself. But the department left the impression that they're reversing recent policies of cracking down on college sexual abuse.
In word and in deed, we're seeing a softening from the Office of Civil Rights, which many people don't understand is housed within the Department of Education, but is responsible for a lot of really important civil rights enforcement in colleges, in public schools, for transgender students, for LGBT, for women, and of course for victims of sexual violence. And so these statements, the public meetings with men's rights advocates, and as well as, again, the cutting slashing of the budget and the slashing of so-called red tape and investigations. I think time will tell. I'm certainly advocates, civil rights groups, women's groups are watching to see without the federal role in enforcement and leadership that they've come to expect during the previous administration, what actually happens then on campus and what happens to civil rights.
Yeah. Well, another concern about the Department of Education right now is they're very behind on hiring. And this isn't because nominations have been held up in Congress. This is just jobs have not been filled. How much is that going to hurt?
You know, again, the notion of a less active and a less activist Department of Education, I think, is a consistent message that we're getting from the president, from the Secretary of Education. She has the only Senate-confirmed position at the Ed Department that's been filled as of the Washington Post tally at the end of June. And as long as, you know, staffing positions remain open, the ability of the Ed Department to do its work is curtailed. And that is combined with public statements repeatedly from the education secretary that she doesn't believe that the federal government should be taking a strong activist role in schools in the first place.
That's Anya Kamenetz, NPR's lead education blogger, catching us up on Secretary Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education. Anya, thank you.
Thank you.
This week, MSNBC announced that for the first time, the news channel became the most watched cable network during weekday prime time. And that's in part thanks to One Voice.
The president's attacks on his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, continued today. It started
MSNBC's
to feel like
Rachel
Jeff
Maddow there. According to Nielsen, MSNBC had 2.3 million primetime viewers between July 17th and 21st. That is ahead of the usual leader, which would be Fox News, which has been struggling since the departure of a number of key executives and show personalities. Joining us to talk about the primetime shakeup is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this is not the first time MSNBC primetime has beat Fox News, but it's the first time it's topped all cable networks. What's your read on this?
Well, let's give a caveat here. It's a weekday figure, and oftentimes cable will try to push a Monday through Sunday figure. And
it's also the middle of July, too.
It's the middle of July. People are outside. There are all kinds of explanations, but it's quite a moment for MSNBC. You know, when it was launched in 1996, the same year that Fox News was launched, people thought MSNBC would be the serious kind of dominant player to take on CNN. And in fact, as we know, the story went quite differently. I think what you're seeing here is people are there's a high level of interest in the news. We've seen it in a significant way for news outlets digitally, people paying for the New York Times, which had a big report this week of how many more digital subscribers they had accrued than expected. And you're also seeing, I think, in the primetime in particular, people flocking for a critical take on the Trump presidency and for looking people looking for them to unpack what's going on Capitol Hill with norms being shattered in so many ways in the nation's capital. So I think you're seeing both a high interest in news and a high interest, particularly in news coming from the left and for liberals and for some perhaps anti-Trump conservatives.
So the same kinds of things that would have boosted Fox News during the Obama years are boosting MSNBC during the Trump presidency.
Oh, yeah. You know, the departed president of Fox News, Bill Shine, told me at the dawn of the Obama administration that it makes it easier for Fox News to be the voice of opposition in a lot of ways, and that it really provided Fox with a clarity of what they were about. Well, now the shoe is on the other foot. MSNBC is much more of a financial and business model for its parent network, NBC, than it is a true ideological commitment. You know, the Rupert Murdoch, who's running Fox News at the moment, the ultimate guy at the head of that pyramid, really is truly a conservative guy. And that's not why MSNBC really is doing this. But it is appealing to an audience that is clamoring for this kind of coverage. And I think they've provided it with a blend of, you know, during primetime, figures long familiar to viewers. It's not like you've swapped out Rachel Maddow or Chris Hayes or Lawrence O'Donnell in those three key hours of primetime. But you're seeing NBC, you know, perhaps bring in some more of its NBC News figures into its programming throughout MSNBC, and also acknowledge that this liberal lineup is the right way to go during the at least this first 6 months of the Trump years.
At the same time, we saw Greta Van Susteren, the former Fox News host who was hired in January by MSNBC and given a show. She suddenly departed MSNBC last month. How does that fit into what's going on at MSNBC? Is she just not liberal enough, or what do you think?
The answer is it didn't fit with what was going on. But that speaks to an underlying tension and dynamic that I heard about from people at MSNBC. There was a desire from Andrew Lack, the head of NBC News, to somehow in some ways distance NBC from the liberal ideological labeling that MSNBC's identity has. And so, you know, he looked to Fox News. He hired with great fanfare Megyn Kelly for NBC News in a variety of roles there. He hired Nicole Wallace, the former George W. Bush communications director, who now has a late afternoon show and who I think is doing actually quite well, at least editorially with that show. Hired Hugh Hewitt and also Greta Van Susteren, not a particularly ideological figure, but nonetheless somebody well-known from viewers of Fox for many years. Well, she didn't quite fit. She didn't have either a particularly liberal sensibility or have a particularly had the right tone and tenor for this highly political age. That isn't necessarily her sweet spot. And therefore, she didn't fit. You know, Andy Lack's desire to try to in some ways dampen that liberal connection didn't work in an age where viewers were hankering for more connection, more identity in some ways, as well as more hard news. Greta was neither an incredibly compelling investigative or enterprise reporter, nor was she an ideologue.
Just in the minute we have left, David, there's news today that President Trump had dinner with Sean Hannity from Fox News and the former executive Bill Shine that you mentioned. What do you make of that?
I think it just shows you the strong ties that that Trump has with the conservative media outlets, particularly with Fox News. You know, he talks regularly with Hannity, who serves as a sounding board and advisor. He talks with Tucker Carlson. He talks with Kimberly Guilfoyle, one of the main hosts of The Five show, and who was also present at that dinner last night. He is closely connected and tethered with the media and with Fox News in particular. It shows you that Fox is as closely binding itself to the Trump White House in just at a time at which MSNBC's primetime is trying to unravel his hold on that office.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.